we're actually trawling through billions of different conversations daily.
Behold the datapocalypse. Yes, this week as the new mandatory data retention scheme is launched, what will it mean for you? What kind of impact will it have on the way you use the web? And it's not just the government that want your data. We're also looking at the way brands are paying to know what you're saying, what you're thinking, and how you're behaving.
So we have direct access to the Twitter firehose. We're tracking Facebook, tracking 300 million blogs.
This is your guide to the week in technology, the internet, and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to Download This Show. And it is a very big welcome to you, person who I assume has a mobile phone and should definitely tweet along with this show. The hashtag is Download This Show. Secondary, slightly less impressive hello to our panelists this week. That's a terrible way of introducing respected technology journalists like Claire Riley from CNET, senior writer. Welcome to Download This Show.
Thank you, Mark.
And Luke Hopewell, the editor of gizmodo.com.au.
Yes.
That good. First up, voice calls. SMSs, email, web browsing, can you feel the metadata passing through you unto the government? Yes, this week, the mandatory data retention scheme came into effect. And so this week, we're exploring the different ways you can address it. We're not necessarily encouraging you to get around it, but if you wanted to, there are a number of ways you could. Let's start with exactly what is being kept. I think there's still a lot of misunderstanding about exactly what sort of data is being kept on you. Luke Hope, I'll start with you.
The simplest explanation for metadata is metadata is data about data. So, for example, we could all have a phone call. The government wouldn't know what we talked about, but it would certainly know that that call was placed. It would know when we connected to the internet, where from, how long it was for, but not what we actually browsed or the emails we sent or any of the apps that we used to connect. That's metadata, and that's being stored for a mandatory period of 2 years by your ISP.
But in some cases, various different telcos did keep some of this information already. We talk about a lot about Telstra having kept a lot of this in the past. So what it's really doing is sort of bringing them all into line with how much data they're going to keep and who can access it, Claire?
That's correct. So essentially they've just legislated to make it more uniform with the way this information is kept so that it can be passed on to law enforcement, national security agencies if they need it. So essentially there are all these different varying systems in place. The AFP have said nothing's changed here. We're just maintaining the status quo. Something I disagree with, but I don't know how early you want me to get into my tinfoil hat, Mark.
I've got it sitting over here. I think we're running at about like 2 minutes. I think tinfoil hat can begin now.
All right, crinkle, let's put it on.
Unfurl the aluminium. Begin.
I think an interesting way to think about it is police, if they are pursuing, say, a missing persons case, they might go to a supermarket and say, can we have access to the surveillance camera footage for Friday night outside your supermarket? Sure thing. Here you go. That's very different to asking every single shop on Main Street to put a surveillance camera both inside and outside their store to run footage 24/7 and to keep that information for 2 years so that police, law enforcement, security agencies can access it without a warrant.
Who's paying for it? So it's obvious that, you know, if Telstra's a big organisation, they've been keeping a lot of this data to begin with. But what about all the other internet service providers? What about the smaller ones? How are they paying for suddenly this huge, massive data they now need to keep?
The government's pouring in, I think it's $131 million to help pay for the metadata retention scheme, which essentially means that you and I are paying for it as taxpayers. But at the end of the day, there is a cost associated with shouldering the burden of storing all of this data and figuring out new ways to collect it. So smaller ISPs have actually said that it's really significantly impacting their business and how they actually go about it day to day.
Will we see smaller ISPs buckle?
I think there's a real risk of that, and those are the kinds of ISPs that are bringing competition into smaller places like regional towns. They're the people that are offering over-the-top or different services to your kind of your Telstra, Optus and Vodafone. So I think it's a real pity that those kind of businesses may struggle under this. I mean, the government said that they're going to prioritise funding for the smaller ISPs and telcos, but really it's a choice of us paying for it as taxpayers or, on the other hand, us paying for it as customers when telcos and ISPs essentially probably put up their prices to help deal with their costs.
Yeah, you're never going to see a little line item in your bill like the GST or like the carbon tax with your energy provider. Basically, all you're going to see is your bill went up. You won't know why, but it might be because they have to store, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of more data every single year.
Yeah, petabytes of data.
One of the arguments put forward when the scheme was sort of first floated was that they would standardise which government departments could access the metadata and for what purpose. Has that transpired?
Look, it has to a certain extent. They limited the number of agencies. So we saw originally police could access it, but also RSPCA, Blacktown Council, kind of small local councils could access and were accessing this kind of information.
For what?
Dumping, rubbish dumping. One of the councils in Sydney, yeah, fining people, which is a whole other kettle of fish. They've actually reduced it down to kind of agencies like your standard law enforcement, state and federal police, ASIO will be able to access. They could probably access.
Yeah, to be fair, I'm quite confident ASIO could have access.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about this is that there's a power written into the legislation that essentially gives the Attorney General, Uncle George, the power to decree that certain organisations and agencies will be able to access this data. So about a month after the legislation passed, that was a power given to the Australian Border Force, and they were declared to be an agency with access to the information, and that wasn't written into the original legislation. So we may see what has been described as scope creep coming into the laws.
Metadata is not so much about, it's about a couple of different things. The best thing that metadata can do is it can say, it can connect you with certain people. So obviously you can say this person called this person, therefore we can infer that these people were in contact with these people, inferring a conspiracy or some sort of contact between a group. That's what metadata can be used for, and a lot of different agencies have a bunch of different ways of using it. Like Barry O'Farrell, the New South Wales Premier, was actually brought down by metadata because they actually found that he had placed a call to the person who sent him that bottle of wine the day after he got it. That you know, implied the corruption, and he was forced to resign. The Jill Maher case, the missing persons case in Melbourne, the metadata was actually used there to find where she was taken, I believe,
and
further prosecute.
And so, and once again, kind of cell phone towers and pinging, so getting location. But you raise a really interesting point, Luke, which is that law enforcement are actually making inferences from this data. So, Mark, you said that the three of us, or someone said, I don't remember, it was already like 5 minutes
Well, were you
ago
on the night of the fair?
Yeah. There was someone in the room.
Yeah, the three of us have a phone call. Well, they're going to pretty much guess, if it's around the time that we're recording this podcast, that it's going to be about the show, the length of time that we're on the phone call for. So when they say it's de-identified information, it's not about the person, it's not about content, you can infer so much information. If you call a suicide hotline at 1 a.m. and your location is pinged on a bridge, you can assume a lot about that phone call. If you call Planned Parenthood and then you call your sister, and you know, you can make a lot of assumptions about a person's actions, behaviors, intentions just through this so-called blank data.
This was a very good week for providers of virtual private networks. Virtual private networks are, of course, supposed to anonymize your location and a number of other sort of metadata points when you sign up to them. It's a bit of software that you can install. Will virtual private networks be as effective as people like to think they will be?
It really depends on the provider of the VPN that you choose, simply because some of them keep logs and some of them don't. So, for example, say you've been looking at something you probably shouldn't have. The government goes up to your VPN provider and says, "Hey, how about Mark Fennell, that customer? What's he been looking at?" I'll say, "Oh yeah,
it was for research.
We kept logs on Mark, and he's just been looking at the weirdest shit. So here you go. Here's that log." You really want to find a VPN provider that's safe offshore, so that it's away from the remit of metadata retention, and something that doesn't keep logs and sort of doesn't snoop on you. Someone you can quote-unquote trust on the internet.
Is it hard to make that purchase decision? Because these are, of course, paid-for services. Is it hard to make that purchase decision when they are offshore, when you don't necessarily have any way of trusting the claims that they make?
There are so many VPN providers around that it can be very, very difficult.
Things, the basics you're looking for and thinking about are, what's the price per month or per year? Where are their server locations? If they've got lots of locations around the world, then if you've got speed problems or anything like that, or privacy issues in certain countries, that's factored in. It's pretty easy to school yourself in it. But you can also use other things like over-the-top services, and there's a whole range of apps and different services and other ways you can kind of circumvent or avoid.
Well, let's talk about that, because Luke Gizmodo did post, have posted a number of articles, but they did post one taking you through step by step how, if you wanted to, you could obscure the amount of metadata you put out in the world to be tracked. Let's go through them one by one.
Of course.
Voice calls.
voice calls are interesting because if you look at voice and SMS, those are two services that actually use traditional networks, that use the cell networks to send their messages back and forth. These are the easiest things to be A, intercepted, and C, generate metadata from, simply because they're easy, predictable, they've been around for decades and decades. If you want to obscure those, you need to start using what Claire mentioned, which is over-the-top services. So the most simple ones you're looking at would be anything that carries voice or messages over a data network. Because the thing about looking at your phone bill, you can have a look at voice services and messages that can be easily snooped on. But a data service can connect to so many different things. The only thing that will generate in terms of metadata is the fact that you connected to a tower somewhere, not what you actually connect to.
And there's a lot of people like the phrase over-the-top service might sound confusing, but you were probably using these kinds of services already. So if you're making Skype calls to your family overseas, that's an over-the-top service. If you're using WhatsApp for free database messaging, that's another service. If you're sending Snapchats, I really don't know how you're going to convey important and secret information via Snapchat, but that is an avenue that is open to you as well.
We should say here that putting less metadata out in the world is not illegal. So it's not like we're advocating you doing something outside the new bounds of the new laws.
Absolutely.
It's just putting less metadata out there.
It's just being concerned about your privacy.
So we've technically, you've covered voice calls. So what you would do is you'd move over to something like Skype. Although I will note that the Electronic Frontiers Foundation have put together a checklist of all the different voice over IP, so the different Skype-esque services out there, evaluating them on the different bits of security. And we will post that on the Download This Show Facebook page. You've also touched on, Claire, there, how you would replace messaging, so SMSs, so you'd be using services like
WhatsApp, iMessage, there's a one called ChatSearch or ChatOn, I can find the name of that, but it's essentially just a message, like Luke said, that's sending something over a data connection, chat secure. So places like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Pirate Party, Australia's favourite Senate minority party, they've put together a really awesome guide linking into a lot of the EFF stuff about here's a guide to setting up Wicca, the kind of burn-on reading messaging app.
Malcolm Turnbull endorsed.
Yeah, Malcolm Turnbull endorsed. Cayman Island approved messaging app. Topical.
Yeah, we should, next time we have one of these conversations, we should organise it over Slack. I hear his suggestion that Cabinet meetings should be organised, should be using Slack has gone down like a brick. What about email?
Email, well, unless you're with an Australian provider, like, you know, I don't know if Turnbull's still
Aussie Mail.
But
there's a lot of Malcolm Turnbull in jokes at this show.
Yeah, technically services like Gmail, any sort of web-based email service is kind of an over-the-top service. But all of these companies, it's worth remembering, they're so big, they're so multinational that it's in their best interest to comply with, you know, Australian law enforcement requests anyway. So it's unlikely that they're going to be like, well, I'm sorry, law enforcement, we're going to protect this random customer's data because we don't want to go there with you.
Side question, what's the reporting on this? Do they have to publish how many requests they make, anything of that nature?
So there's a couple of different tiers of reporting. Obviously, the big players, your Facebook, Twitter, Google and stuff like that, they publish, they do quarterly disclosure announcements where they publish exactly who's requisitioned the data and how many of those requests they've complied with. As far as reporting for metadata retention is concerned, there is an oversight sort of branch. There's a little officer that sits there that that has to do a little check. Say, for example, the AFP wants to access a journalist metadata, for example. They now have to go through this little oversight area. But that's also someone who's going to be enforcing the rules as far as metadata collection is concerned.
And also the Attorney General's Department releases a really fun report every year that I look forward to. That's the number of requests made, who made them, whether they were approved, things like that. So the information's out there. The oversight branch of this is interesting because it's actually a branch of the government or a kind of a division, I guess, that's being defunded and kind of conglomerated with other divisions. So the Office of the Information Commissioner, it's the, sort of the role of the Privacy Commissioner, and all of these different roles have kind of been bundled together in one. So there is the issue around, you know, how much oversight there'll be. And it's all oversight after the fact. So any...
It's already happened.
It's not... It's
already
kind of,
been taken.
Yeah, it's the difference between sort of seeking forgiveness rather than asking for approval. And it's not a warrant-based system. So anything anything that's kind of overseen is all going to be happening after the information has been shared. And in the case of really sensitive information, the damage has already been done.
The problem with that as well is that it's also massively toothless as far as a government organisation is concerned. I don't think there's ever been an Office of the Information Commissioner report that's come out about mandatory data breach notifications that's ever been more than, well, that was very naughty, don't do it again.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that we touch on as well is, I mean, this is an issue that's particularly close to my heart, the idea that you're creating this honeypot potentially for hackers.
Massively.
And we do not have in Australia a legal system that requires companies, the government, whoever, to disclose if their information has been breached. So we saw with Catch of the Day, the shopping website, they failed to disclose a major data breach of their customer records. They kept it quiet for 3 years. And so in that time, you've got the same password likely on Catch of the Day as you do with maybe eBay. If you're really stupid, you've got it on your banking as well. People are able to get information, and this all comes back into this whole idea of all the data points about you. It's not your credit card details that are important anymore. That was the real furphy that came out this week. It's like, oh, well, they're not getting your credit card details. It's just about where you go and who you call. But you can build up a picture of someone that is so much more accurate. And credit card, I don't need that. If I'm talking about identity theft, I need personal identifiers, and that is much more dangerous than just getting someone's credit card number.
Are there any rules around what level of security this metadata needs to be kept at?
It would be industry standard, which is the basic thing of storing data at rest in a data center. I'm not hugely familiar with the actual security standard of that, but it would be encrypted and it would be stored on servers that would be difficult to get into. But let's not pretend this hasn't happened before. When data retention was put back on the table by this government, hackers under the flag of anonymous, you know, sort of decentralized, if you will, actually went into the data center of AAPT and actually pulled out a ton of data that was just sitting at rest of customers that had left the provider and made it available for the public to have a look at, to say, look, this was easy and you're not even storing it yet.
Another thing that's problematic in this case is when Border Force was granted access to metadata, Senator Scott Ludlam pointed out that the Immigration Department last year accidentally disclosed the personal details of 10,000
yes.
asylum seekers, really personal information. It's like, well, you might not care what the government thinks about you, but the Iranian secret police might want to have this information. So anytime you're creating a large bulk of information, it's not a matter of if that information will be breached or hacked, it's a matter of when.
Once the data exists, and this has come up a couple of times on the show, but once the data exists, can it be sued for by movie studios, TV studios looking to sue to find the details of people who've pirated?
When the Australian Federal Police stood up with Uncle George Brandis, as Claire named him, which
his official title,
the best name ever.
The Honourable Uncle George.
They said, they answered a very stupid question the Australian Federal Police did, and said that yes, we can certainly use this metadata for you know, finding movie piracy and things like that for
private
interest groups.
And they backpedaled so quickly the next day.
They opened up a hole in the space time continuum, backpedaling.
Oh,
so
that's
fast.
Lance Armstrong level pedaling.
Like yeah.
that was insane. They pinky promise that they won't use it for private interests groups and using it for finding piracy and civil legislation and things like that. But let's be perfectly honest, we could do this all day with talking about government data breaches. Their record is shit out.
But the reality is piracy isn't actually a crime.
But the problem is...
But it's once the data exists...
Big air quotes.
Yeah, but it isn't like we had...
The police aren't going to be accessing it. Like, it's not a question of police accessing the information. It's a question of you have 2 years worth of data that all of the studios and rights
holders
now
know
exists.
Once they know it's there, they know they can sue for it.
And in the case of, say, the Dallas Buyers Club case, we saw a studio rights holders coming after an ISP and saying, all right, we think you might have records. Do you have records of people accessing this torrent between March and July? And then the ISP was like, well, yes, we do. We have to tell you that. Now, Dallas Buyers Club or the Dallas Buyers Clubs of the future know that ISPs have 2 years worth of data. They know that they can sue in a civil case for that. You could see other civil cases beyond piracy. You could see family court matters or, disputes between spouses being kind of resolved using metadata and the tracking of one party in a particular case. space.
Download This Show is what you are listening to. It is your guide to the week in technology, the internet, culture. Mark Fennell is my name. We are in studio here with Luke Hopewell, the editor of the technology website Gizmodo Australia, and Claire Riley, who is a senior writer at the technology site CNET. And finally here on the show, it's reasonable to assume that it's not just governments interested in building a digital profile of you, or at least accessing data about you. Corporations, brands are constantly scraping the web to build an image not just of you, but actually more interesting to them is what you think about them. So how do they do it? How does it work? And what does it look like? This guy knows.
My name is David Hickey. I'm the area director for Meltwater. We're a software company that's focused around monitoring and analyzing news and social media in particular for businesses to help them understand what's being said about their brand, their competitors and their industry in real time. Essentially, we monitor millions and millions of conversations that are happening across news and social media, but also provides them with the tools to help them analyze those conversations. We track 255,000 news sources every 5 to 10 minutes for our clients' keywords. And we're actually trawling through billions of different conversations daily. So we have direct access to the Twitter fire hose. We're tracking Facebook, tracking 300 million blogs. And then it will basically go out, a crawler will go out, grab the information as it gets put online, pull it back into our system, and then you'll be able to access it in real time through an app. Say, for instance, the Minerals Council of Australia, which is maybe an out-of-the-box client. They care about any kinds of mentions to do with coal, which is obviously very topical. In terms of where the most meaningful data can come from, Facebook's an interesting one, obviously, because they really need to respect the privacy and of what is typically quite a private conversation between users. So Meltwater can give you all of the public information. I think Facebook is a critical one, but for us, what we find is being able to have access to all of that data, not just focused around one particular medium, is the best way to give you a true indication of trend and positioning.
That is David Hickey from Meltwater there. Download This Show is what you're listening to. It is your guide to the week in technology, the internet and culture. Back here in studio with our panelists, Claire Riley from CNET and Luke Hopewell from Gizmodo. The idea of people, of corporations data mining you is creepy, except for the fact that it's all very public information, isn't it?
If you don't want corporations to know what you think of them, don't say it on their goddamn Facebook page. It can't be any simpler.
I mean, you'd think so, but somehow it's like when people post selfies when they're drunk driving, or it's just like sometimes the people on the internet are just too stupid to exist.
Do you think people are aware of how much of, you know, that there are services out there that aren't just, that exist to pull things in from the ether and create an actionable image?
I reckon that in this room and a lot of people listening, we've got kind of early tech adopters and people who are interested in this kind of thing. But I still get questions of, hold on, I was on looking at shoes the other day and then I got an ad on Facebook for the same shoes.
All the time.
How did they know? And it's like, well, that's cookies, and that's a really base level thing. I was at a presentation this week, and I realized midway through that it was directed to salespeople, and I was just like, oh, I'm in the wrong room.
Midway through?
I'm in a room filled with salespeople. Oh, that's why I feel poor. It makes sense now.
They had nice clothes and rich people hair. But they were essentially
talking about nylon.
Yeah, they were talking about the future of advertising and essentially things called context engines, which is, now Mark Fennell goes online, it's not just about the sites you're visiting, it's about the sites you're visiting at times of day. And now we can loop those data points in with you walking past a shop based on your GPS at a particular time of day and then going into the store. Where are you lingering in the store? We get that information from Bluetooth beacons. And so we can link all those data points up together. They were even talking about wearables, detecting your blood sugar and knowing not to pitch a sale at you when you're a little bit hangry, which is something I can totally appreciate.
Or pitch me muffins when I'm there.
Absolutely.
Muffins all the time.
But it's this information can be scraped from everywhere. Social media is only the really top level stuff. And if there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on, if you don't realize you talking about Virgin Australia or Qantas or whether you want to catch an Emirates flight, that's being fed back to these big companies so that they can micromanage all their analytics, then it's a really big thing.
When does scraping go too far for you, Luke? Like that example of, you know, I was looking at something on the web, a shoe store, and then suddenly I got served with Facebook ads. Is there ever a point where you get uncomfortable with it?
Scraping goes a little bit too far when you see something in there that brands can infer about you where you really shouldn't expect it at all. I'm talking about where you keep your money, and I'm talking about your healthcare. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, big data is this word that these companies use. They listen because they get big data and they can analyze it and stuff like that.
And it's really important, but every time someone says big data, I just switch off because it sounds so boring.
We're all
but
talking
it's so
about,
important.
We're all talking about hashtag brands right here.
Yeah.
the thing about banking is that, say, for example, some banks are now telling you, oh, put your loyalty cards into our app and we can just, you know, get them to scan the screen rather than having a wallet full of loyalty cards.
Oh,
what happens
boring.
When a million people have, you know, 10 different loyalty cards in their mobile wallet, for example, the bank can then infer, hey, these people all have Starbucks cards, or these people all have Everyday Rewards cards, or different sort of brands that they can then partner up with to sell you better. This is where I keep my money because it's less convenient than keeping it under my mattress.
And they're not doing this out of benevolence. They're doing this because of the all-ity olla.
It's quite funny. I met the president of Pixar Animation Studios in the States the other day.
Did you hug him?
I did, and it was weird. But he gave me his card, and I used one of those apps where you can kind of digitize people's business cards. And I used the free one and I digitized this card and suddenly I realized all of the banner ads and all of my other free apps suddenly became ads for
Frozen.
Basically, yeah. It was Walt Disney, Pixar. And a little part of me goes, well, firstly, that's brilliant because who doesn't love Pixar?
Great.
But it's also like I didn't give it a second thought until I realized it was blanket. Everything, everywhere I went online was Disney ads. It was like they thought I was a four-year-old or something.
I have a similar experience because I was trying to find children's shoes in a lady's size for a costume and for personal needs that I don't need to talk about on radio. But now I'm getting some weird ads. I also a while ago told Facebook that I lived in Sweden so that it didn't target me too much. And I get weird ads. My age is a little bit different, so I get a lot of elderly dating ads. Like, the internet, my metadata is pretty safe because the picture it is made of me is so confusing to people.
It's like the Google thing. Like when you
I was just about to say that. Like, if you go onto Google advertising, you can have a look at your advertising profile.
I'm a 16-year-old girl.
Google still thinks I'm a 24-year-old woman. It's fantastic.
It's amazing.
So all we discovered is that basically we're hoping the government is better at managing metadata.
Let's just log off.
Yeah.
Well, so ended our metadata special here on Download This Show. Let us know if there's other stuff you'd like the show to cover on our Facebook page. Just look for RN Download This Show. Very big thank you to our panelists this week. Luke Hopewell from the technology website gizmodo.com.au. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
And Claire Riley, whose work you can find on cnet.com.
Thank you.
My name is Mark Fidel. We will see you, hear you, sense your presence next week. Thanks for listening.